It's a real pleasure to be with you again this morning. When when Greg asked me to do Sunday school, it's not a great burden. I have a sort of, I think what Americans call a candy cane Sunday school on Martin Luther. So don't be too impressed by me stepping up to do Sunday school. I'm giving you a talk that I've given a million times before. I hope that none of you have found it on the internet, and therefore it could be perhaps more interesting than it might otherwise have been. I want to speak about Martin Luther. I talk about Luther because, although I'm not a Lutheran, Luther is without doubt the single most important figure in the Protestant Reformation, and both positively and negatively, he sets the framework for later Protestant discussion. And if you're a Protestant today, then you're indebted to some extent to Martin Luther. Yet he's more often honored as a symbol, I think. People talk about Luther without actually knowing much about his life. And what I want to do today is grab just six brief moments in his life to look at them as a way of opening his life up to you. I recommend as books to read. I noticed that Steve Nichols' little book on Martin Luther is for sale on the bookshelves out there. That's a great introduction to Martin Luther. My favorite is still Roland Bainton, Here I Stand, partly because it's got pictures in it, and it's always great. You get a thick book and you find out that half of it's pictures. It's sort of great because, you know, it takes less effort to get through to the end. And the other one I recommend is Martin Marty's very short biography in the Penguin Short Lives, entitled, I think, imaginatively enough, Martin Luther. The Penguin Short Lives is a great series, actually, of lives of great men and women through history. It's about 150 pages a pop, so they're great for if you're commuting or you've got a short trip somewhere and you're wanting something quick to read. And Martin Marty is very good on pulling up facts that I haven't found anywhere else. He, for example, I didn't realize that Luther had worked as a carpenter for a while when he was a reformer, because being a reformer didn't pay a lot. He had to do other things to make ends meet. So he set himself up as a carpenter and was so bad at it and had so many complaints that he had to close the business down fairly quickly. Then he and his wife worked as gardeners in Wittenberg, and they used to do people's gardens for money too. So those are three or four books worth looking at. Who was Martin Luther? Well, the first thing I want to talk about is the lightning bolt that brings him to public prominence, or sets in action the events that will bring him to public prominence. He was born in 1483 in a place called Eisleben in Germany. Ironically, or interesting enough, he will die in Eisleben. He doesn't spend much time in Eisleben at all in his life, but he's both born there and he will die there on a preaching tour in 1546. 1484, his family moved to a little town called Mansfeld. His father did not inherit the family farm. He was born to peasant stock, but German inheritance law meant that his father, as the oldest son, didn't inherit the family farm. I think it was a way of protecting the younger children in inheritance law. So his father had to go off and do something else, and his father became a miner. And mining, of course, is a very tough profession now. It must have been even tougher in the 16th century. But Luther's father rose from being a miner to being the manager, the superintendent of a mine. And that's a powerful indication of the times in which he lived. Luther's father was able to enjoy class mobility, we might say today. And that instilled in him an ambition for his children. I grew up in a family, nobody prior to my generation, my family, had ever been to college. And I remember my father, the one thing I knew from the moment I was able to speak was whatever else I was going to do with my life, I was going to go to college, because that's what my father had never done. He had these ambitions for me. And Luther's father has ambitions for his son, that his son will not have to work with his hands, but his son will go to university and will become a lawyer. Are there any lawyers here? Oh. I'm surprised. Normally people are too ashamed to admit that in public, but it's... I was going to say, if you have no integrity, being a lawyer is the way to make money at any point in history. So Luther's father has great ambitions for his son. I have a lot of lawyer jokes, but given that there is a lawyer present, I'll spare you those. You've probably heard them a million times, yes, but they're still good to tell again, I feel. Anyway, in 1501, he he goes to the University of Erfurt, one of the great ancient universities in Germany. He matriculates there and he starts his studies. And then in 1505, he's been home visiting his parents for a while, and he's traveling back. He's walking back to the University of Erfurt, and he's caught in the middle of an almighty thunderstorm. And a bolt of lightning comes crashing down at his side. I'm one of those people. I've been narrowly missed by lightning twice in my life. And it's a pretty frightening experience. When it happens the first time, it's terrifying. When it happens the second time, you start to get really worried that sooner or later, wow, it's gonna hit the target. Lightning is terrifying. I remember the first time I was standing in my back room, I was on the phone to somebody, and the lightning bolt came down into our back garden. And by the time you realize what's happened, it's all over. You suddenly see this sort of what seemed to be like a 6-foot pillar of light in the back garden, blue light, and then the whole house shook and things fell off the shelves. Absolutely terrifying. Of course, I have some primitive understanding of what lightning is. I know that it's ice crystals, I think, bashing around in the upper atmosphere, creating a sort of ionic imbalance or something that sends this powerful bolt of lightning down to the earth. But that wouldn't have been the way in the 16th century. Luther was very much a man of the Middle Ages. They didn't know that lightning was caused by ice crystals. If you lived in the 16th century and you saw lightning, it was the judgment of God. It was an act of God. We still have that, I think, on our insurance policies. If your house is sort of blown away by a bolt of lightning, probably, technically, it's an act of God on the insurance policy. And that's a sort of, almost like a folk memory of how it would have been understood in the 16th century. So when Luther is thrown to the ground by this bolt of lightning, for him, that is, it's a wake-up call from God. And as he falls to the ground, he cries out, "St. Anne, help me, and I will become a monk." For years I wondered, why did he pray to St. Anne at that point? And of course, I then found out that St. Anne is actually the patron saint of miners. And therefore, he was reflecting the piety of his household. Presumably, he was brought up as a child when his father was down the mine. The person they would have prayed to for the safety of his father would have been St. Anne. And so we have this moment where, in a moment of crisis for Luther, he's thrown to the ground and he calls out to St. Anne to help him. And within a few days, he goes and presents himself at the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt. And he becomes an Augustinian monk. His father's furious. Medieval monastic orders are a bit like colleges or universities today. There's definitely a ranking order. And, you have your Harvards and your Yales. That would have been the Dominicans and the Franciscans. They were the elite order. And Luther's father was furious enough that his son was no longer going into law, but he hadn't even chosen one of the elite orders to join. He'd chosen the Augustinians, and the Augustinians were the equivalent of a sort of third rank kind of college, third or fourth rank kind of college. So his father was furious. But Luther joined the Augustinian order in 1505. He was ordained as a priest in 1507. And that's important because it meant that Luther was not just, he was never going to be just a professor. He was never going to be just a monk. He was also going to be involved in the pastoral care of people in his parish. And then in 1508, he was invited to transfer to Wittenberg and to join the faculty of the university in Wittenberg, where he will spend much of the rest of his life. So that's the first moment then, the first moment, the lightning bolt. Second thing I want to look at is the crisis of 1517. Now, if you were in the church in the Middle Ages, you'd have been taught various things that hopefully you don't get taught in this church. You don't teach about purgatory, I hope, Greg. Good. I don't have to charge you with anything then when I get back to Philadelphia. Medieval Catholicism taught that there were three destinies after death. There was heaven for the saints, there was hell for those who died outside of the church, and there was purgatory. And purgatory was the place where most Christians would go when they die in order to be purged of the remaining sin within their lives, to fit them for heaven. And it was purgatory was not a happy place. If you've, you know, Dante's great poem, the Divine Comedy, there is a section on purgatory there, and it's not a good place, it's a painful place to be. The big difference between purgatory and hell is that purgatory does come to an end at some point. And in the later Middle Ages, what the church had done was it had developed a way whereby one could get out of purgatory early. You die and you go to purgatory to be purged. But if you paid the church for an indulgence, which is like a certificate, a piece of paper, a certificate, if you paid the church for an indulgence, that indulgence could allow you to have a certain amount of time off purgatory. Or it could help you get time off purgatory for a loved one. So, you know, your granny dies, and you loved her, but you knew she was a hard woman. And you're pretty confident she's doing a long stretch in purgatory. But you loved her. And you've got some spare cash, so you could buy an indulgence from the church to get, say, 1,000 years or 10,000 years off purgatory for grandma. And you could shorten her suffering there. It's a powerful, you know, it grips the imagination powerfully, that kind of thing. And before we sort of take a kind of pharisaical, I thank you, Lord, that I am not like other men, attitude to the medieval church, I would say it's, you know, functionally, it's no different to what the prosperity teachers preach on the TV. You know, we'll pray for you. If your prayer isn't answered, then maybe you didn't send enough money. That's just a Protestant form of an indulgence, frankly. And I think the Protestants these days, have generally, we are better at selling indulgences, one might say, than the Catholic Church is. Well, that's a bit of background. The Pope at the time was a man called Leo X. Leo X had pretty much bankrupted the papacy, been involved in various wars, and also he had commissioned the building of the Sistine Chapel. And if you've ever been to Rome, the Vatican Museum has to be one of the most beautiful art collections on the face of the planet. So I think it's insured for a total of $10 or something like that. When I did the tour, the tour guide said, you know, it's insured for $10. It has to be insured for something, but, you know, what do you do if the Sistine Chapel burns down? You know, you can't go to IKEA and, you know, replace it. It's done. So it's worth, you know, it's of incalculable worth, but it's also sort of worthless for insurance purposes. And of course, Leo X had employed some of the great men of the art world to do the Sistine Chapel and the Vatican. If you walk into St. Peter's in Rome, one of the first things that you come across is the Pietà, which is Michelangelo's sculpture of the Virgin Mary cradling Christ has come down from the cross. And if you set aside sort of Second Commandment issues and just look at it as a piece of artwork, it's a stunning piece of artwork. And he was, I think, 24 when he did it. And so he was 24 years old when he carved this. And he lived to a ripe old age. You know, I think when I was 24, I just wanted to sit and watch rugby on the television and drink beer out of a can, you know. That was what I was doing age 24. Michelangelo is producing the Pietà. So these are, you know, the Pope is employing artistic geniuses, and, you know, Michelangelo is only one of them. But they don't come cheap. It's expensive. And so the papacy has been pretty much bankrupted by Leo X's military ambitions and by his artistic ambitions. But events in Germany are moving towards helping Leo X get out of this hole. There's a man called Albrecht of Mainz, and Albrecht of Mainz is the bishop of 2 bishoprics in Germany. And he wants a third, but there's a problem. You can only, by law, have 2 bishoprics. If you want a third, guess what? You have to buy a license from the Pope in order to get permission to have the 3rd bishopric. So Albrecht and the Pope come to this great, you know, humanly speaking, it's a brilliant business deal, in that Albrecht is allowed to borrow money from the bankers, German bankers, to buy the license. And then the Pope allows Albrecht to raise an indulgence, that is to sell an indulgence, on his territory, and half of the money goes towards paying the capital and interest on the loan, and half of the money goes straight to the papacy. So the Pope really doubled. You know, there's a reason why the Roman Catholic Church has been so successful. I would never bet against them on a business deal. The Pope gets twice. He gets the money for the indulgence, And he also gets half the money, sorry, he gets the money for the license, and he gets half the money generated by the indulgence. And a man called Tetzel is commissioned to make his way up through Germany, selling these indulgences. And he's a really skillful salesman. He had a couple of particular sales pitches. One of them was, every time a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. Powerful rhetoric. If you believe in purgatory, that's powerful rhetoric. He also engaged in a much more profane and blasphemous sales pitch. He apparently was telling people that even, you know, people would ask him how strong your indulgence is, and he would say, even if you had raped the Virgin Mary, one of my indulgences would be sufficiently powerful to cover the sin for you. So he was a shockingly effective salesman, and he makes his way up through Germany. He gets close to Wittenberg, but he's not allowed into Wittenberg. He's not allowed into Wittenberg for an interesting reason. The Prince of Wittenberg, Frederick the Wise, who will be Luther's great sponsor for some years, Frederick the Wise has got his own little trade in relics and indulgences going, so he doesn't want Tetzel cutting into that. So Tetzel is not allowed into Electoral Saxony, where Wittenberg is. But Luther, as the parish priest, is aware that members of his congregation are crossing over the river into Ducal Saxony and buying indulgences there. How many of you have seen the recent Luther movie? You can get it on Netflix, I think. It's well worth watching. It compresses the chronology a bit at points, but it gets the indulgence crisis really nicely, because there is this moment where Luther's walking down the streets of Wittenberg, and a young girl comes up, and she's got a baby strapped to her shoulder, and I don't think it's clear if it's a sibling, or is she a very young mother? It's not clear. But Luther says something to the effect of, you know, have you used that money I gave you to buy food or clothing? And she says, no, I bought something much better. And she waves this piece of paper at him and says, I bought an indulgence. And Luther at this point turns away, and there's a sort of scowl on his face. And you know, it's that kind of Hollywood moment. It's all about to go down at this point. Luther is troubled. He's not troubled by the sale of indulgences. He's not quite sure on what the church's position on indulgences is at this point. But he's troubled that people are being conned into thinking they can buy the grace of God. And so on October the 31st, 1517, Luther nails to the castle door at Wittenberg 95 theses, 95 statements against indulgences. It's not a particularly radical move. Luther's actually said more radical things previously, and nobody bothered with him. If you read the 95 theses against indulgences, you really need to have a pretty good grasp of late medieval theology to understand what most of them are talking about. It's a pretty tedious tract in many ways. It was advertising a university debate, but the debate never takes place. The 95 theses are translated into German, turned into a pamphlet, and spread like wildfire across the German lands at this point. And the time is ripe. People are fed up with the church and the corruption. It's just that right moment to light the fuse for the Reformation. And it's this that catapults Luther into the public eye. Luther himself, looking back nearly 30 years later in 1545, was unimpressed with his own take on indulgences. He considered himself to be a thoroughly loyal son of the Pope at that point. This is how he describes 1517 from the perspective of 1545. Above all, he says, I beseech the Christian reader and beg him, for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ, to read my earliest books very circumspectly and with much pity, knowing that before now I too was a monk and one of the right frantic and raving papists. When I took up this matter against indulgences, I was so full and drunken, yea, so besotted in papal doctrine, that out of my great zeal I would have been ready to murder. At least I would have been glad to see and help that murder should be done on all who would not be obedient and subject to the Pope, even to his smallest word. So Luther looks back and sees 1517. It's the moment when the argument starts. But he himself, he felt he was being a loyal son of the church at that point. And I think he was correct. I think what he was doing was, I think what Luther thought was going on with Tetzel was bad. And if the Pope knew about it, the Pope would close Tetzel down. Remember, Europe's, without mass transport, Europe's a very big place. And it takes time for news to get from Rome to Wittenberg. It's very easy to have mavericks doing all kinds of things in Europe in the name of the church. And I think Luther thinks if the Pope knew that God's grace is being peddled for cash, he would close this down. We all know, of course, Luther was naive on that. This was actually going on with the backing of the Pope. So then, the lightning bolt, the protest of 1517. Third, the debate at Heidelberg. Church makes a fatal mistake in 1517. Should have had Luther arrested and transported to Rome straight away, but they don't. They don't realize the seriousness of what's happening. And Luther is allowed to continue with impunity in Electoral Saxony. And in April 1518, he makes his way to a regional meeting of the Augustinian order. It's a routine meeting. It's the equivalent of a presbytery meeting, if you like. It's not specially called. It's just a routine business meeting for the order. And Luther is asked if he will preside at a debate at Heidelberg and if he will prepare the theses for debate. And I think it is in April 1518 that we see real Reformation theology starting to emerge onto the public stage. The debate at Heidelberg, Luther takes aim both at the theology and the philosophy of the medieval church, and he articulates what has come to be known as the notion of the theologian of glory and the theologian of the cross. I just want to read you a couple of quotations from the Heidelberg disputation and then offer a few thoughts on them. Luther says this: "That person does not deserve to be called a theologian who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened." What's he saying there? He's saying that there are people out there that have called themselves theologians, but really what they do is they look at the way the world is and they extrapolate from that to how God must be. And for Luther, that is the characteristic of all of us. Instinctively, we are all what Luther will call, what he's describing there, is a theologian of glory. We assume that God is like us, only so much bigger and so much better. This will really impact how Luther understands justification. If I want you to like me, what am I going to do? I'm going to do nice things for you, aren't I? I'm not going to walk up and slap you. I'm not going to walk up and criticize your dress sense. I'm going to do nice things. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, what would I want that person to do for me if I'm going to like him? I'd want him to flatter me, do nice stuff, give me things. For Luther, that lies at the heart of the human problem in approaching God. We make the assumption that God's logic is our logic. That if God's going to like us, we've got to do good stuff first in order to make ourselves attractive to him. Luther sets in opposition to that this. He said, "He deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering and the cross." For Luther, how does one know God? Well, one knows God by looking at him where he has chosen to reveal himself. And he has chosen to reveal himself above all in the flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ, specifically as crucified on the cross. If you go into a Lutheran church, you'll notice that the aesthetics, the art in a Lutheran church is very similar to a Catholic church. There'll be crucifixes, there'll be paintings of the cross with Christ hanging on it. And that's a very conscious thing on the part of Lutherans, standing in the tradition of Luther, who felt that it was important to be reminded of how small God had become in Christ's flesh, in order to remind us that God is the antithesis of what we expect him to be. Luther goes on, he says, "A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is." The cross for Luther at Heidelberg in 1518 turns our theological vocabulary on its head. How do you get to life? By going through death. How does God demonstrate his power? By making himself weak. How are Christians powerful? Through their weakness. All of the vocabulary that we're tempted to read in very human terms, Luther flips it on its head. He says the cross is a fundamental contradiction of that. And then it culminates, the debate at Heidelberg, in probably the most beautiful sentence that Luther ever wrote, possibly the most beautiful sentence ever written anywhere outside of the Bible. Luther says this, and there is a world of theology in this statement. The love of God does not find, but creates that which is pleasing to it. The love of man comes into being through that which is pleasing to it. Let me read that again. The love of God does not find, but creates that which is pleasing to it. The love of man comes into being through that which is pleasing to it. If you've ever been in love, if you're married, if you've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend, what was the dynamic of how the relationship started? You know, probably you're in a crowded room, your eyes met across a crowded room, and you saw something in that person that attracted you. You probably didn't stand in the crowded room, look across and see someone there and say, oh, she's terrible, I could never, ever marry her. And that was what triggered you to fall in love with her. That isn't the way it goes. Human love is reactive and responsive. It sees an intrinsic quality in an object that draws love out. Why did I fall in love with my wife? Because I saw something beautiful in her that drew my love out towards her. Luther here says, that's human love, but it's not divine love. The love of God does not find, but creates that which is pleasing to it. Luther says, you know, he's really saying here, at the heart of theologies of glory, at the heart of the theologian of glory, is a fundamental misunderstanding of how God's love operates. God's love does not find, but creates that which is lovely to him. Why does God love his people? Not because they were first intrinsically lovely. Very opposite, but because God decided unilaterally to make the church lovely. And I would say you could, you know, you can build, in some ways, you can build Luther's whole theology out of that single sentence. It's certainly consistent with that sentence. So, third thing then, the debate at Heidelberg, April 1518, when Luther lays out what will be the framework for his Reformation theology. If you go to Heidelberg today, the Augustinian monastery has been demolished, but there's actually a flagstone with a marker on it where, so say, Luther stood as he presided over this debate. Next thing, the diet of worms. As a kid, I used to love learning a history lesson. The diet of worms is such a great sort of title, isn't it? By 1521, the church has excommunicated Luther. It's booted him out. It's left the empire and the church with a sort of classic OPC problem, in that they've excommunicated him, but he hasn't gone away. He's still there. And I don't know if you've seen, there's a, you know, some years ago at Westminster, I had to, we fired somebody, but they didn't go away. And I remember my secretary saying to me, what do we do? And I said, well, I don't know. Because, you know, normally the answer to this situation is you fire somebody. But we tried that, and it doesn't seem to have had the desired effect at this particular moment. Luther's been excommunicated. He's a non-person, but he's still there, and he's still causing trouble. So they decide the emperor, the empire's got to deal with him. But how do you summons a non-person? He's a non-person. He doesn't exist officially. He's been excommunicated. So they finally decide to basically ignore the rules and summons him anyway. And he's summoned to the city of Worms in Germany, to face the massed ranks of the empire. You know, well, I keep using the word Germany, but Germany didn't actually exist in the later Middle Ages. Germany is really a 19th century invention. What I mean is the German-speaking lands of North Central Europe, which form what they call the Holy Roman Empire, which was ruled by the emperor. And the emperor was elected by the seven electors. And Luther had the good fortune of being in electoral Saxony. So his prince, his protector, was one of the electors and therefore had quite a bit of influence within the empire to protect Luther. Luther is summoned to meet with the emperor, the electors, and the massed ranks of church and nobility in Worms. And you can imagine as he goes into this hall, they're rebuilding it for the 1517 celebrations in Worms. He goes into the hall, and here's this man who 4 years ago was just a professional academic and monk. Nobody had ever heard of him. Now he stands before the massed ranks of the empire. Probably would have been a room maybe similar in size to this. Luther would have been there, and there would have been the most powerful men in Europe would have been gathered in this one room. And Luther knows that attending imperial diets, attending these great councils, There are not good historical precedents for surviving as a controversial churchman in these things. John Huss, just over 100 years previously, had gone under an imperial safe conduct, a guarantee of safety, to the Council of Constance, and they had revoked his safe passage when he got there and burned him at the stake. So when Luther gets to Worms, he knows that there is a reasonable chance that he may not be coming home from this one. And Luther, on Wednesday the 17th of April, Luther is led into this hall. And at the front of the hall there had been this great table, and all of his books were laid out on this table. And he was asked if these books were his, and if he would repudiate their content. Luther then indicated that he would answer the questions first in German and then in Latin. He's making a kind of what we might call a nationalist point. From the word go, he said, I'm a German problem. Not a European problem, I'm a German problem. He's going to answer the questions in German and then in Latin. And then as he looks at the books, we have one of the most mysterious moments in Reformation history. He's been asked the obvious questions. Are these your books and do you stand by them? Those questions aren't coming out of left field. He would have known he was going to be asked those questions. He looks at the books and he says, because the matters they deal with are so serious, I need 24 hours to think about my answer. And nobody knows why he gave that answer. The simplest explanation would be, he's frightened. You know, he's a human being, he's frightened, and if he's going to go to the stake, he wants to make absolutely certain that he really does stand by everything he's written. A more subtle explanation, which is quite plausible, I think, is that it was part of the electoral Saxon strategy to wrong foot the opposition. We just don't know. Anyway, the meeting convenes the following day. Luther is once again asked the question, and at this point he says, I divide my work into three. Some of them deal with piety and morals, and even my opponents have liked those. I won't retract them. Some are against the papacy, but the papacy has destroyed and tortured so many souls. I'm not going to retract those. And then he points to the diet. He says this council itself has been convened in order to deal with problems within the papacy, so I should not be the only one on trial here. And thirdly, he said, I've written against individuals who defended the Roman tyranny. And occasionally, he says, I've been over the top in how I've described them, but I believe them to be fundamentally sound. And the whole place just breaks up into chaos at that point. Luther makes his famous speech, unless I'm convinced by the testimony of the scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust either in the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves. I am bound by the scriptures I have quoted, and my conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and I will not retract anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. May God help me. Amen. And later versions of that add, here I stand, I can do no other. Probably didn't say it, but it's kind of cool to add that at the end. We can say that he sort of thought it, even if he didn't actually say it. Luther is whisked out of the building at this point, amid cries from the Spanish contingent that he be taken straight out and burned. Luther is all then whisked away from Worms. He rides off from Worms. And as he's riding back to Wittenberg, escaping from the man who would burn him at the stake, he's surrounded by a group of masked men, and he's kidnapped. And it was a setup by Electoral Saxony. Frederick the Wise, Luther's own protector, arranged for the kidnapping of his own man in order to lift him out of the public eye and squirrel him away in the castle of the Wartburg, which stands on a mountain high above the town of Eisenach in Germany. Eisenach, if you go to Germany, it's well worth visiting because you get the Wartburg up on the mountain. And who was born in Eisenach? Which other famous Lutheran was born in Eisenach? Johann Sebastian Bach. So you have the Bach Museum in the town, and you have Luther up on the mountain. So it's a real two-for-one place to go. Some fun stories of while he's there. He spends much of his time translating the New Testament into German. He's supposed to, of course, thrown an ink pot at the devil who appeared to him in his study room When I was there a couple of years ago, I looked for the stain and couldn't find it anywhere, so I think that may be an apocryphal story. And he would also go out, he would travel incognito to see how the Reformation was progressing in Germany. And there's a lovely story of a couple of students arriving in a pub late one evening, and they're ordering their beer, and they look across and they see a knight, bearded knight with a great big sword, sitting in the corner, reading the Psalter in Hebrew, which is an unusual activity for knights to engage in the Middle Ages in Germany. So they go over and engage him in conversation. They're on their way to Wittenberg to matriculate. And the knight spends the evening expounding Christ from the Hebrew text of the Psalter for these students. And at the end of the evening, he disappears. And they find that he's paid their bill. That's kind of nice. You know, they've had this chat with him. He's paid their bill. Some months later, when Luther returns to Wittenberg and goes into lecture, these guys recognize him. That was the night we met in the pub. It's also after the Diet of Worms, Luther becomes the first pinup. The trade in Luther posters explodes in Germany at this point. And, you know, I have two sons, not daughters, but, you know, I imagine if you have daughters, you'd dread that moment when some kind of guy with too much hair or too little hair appears on their bedroom wall in a sort of poster. Well, you know, your nightmare in the 16th century would have been you walk into your daughter's bedroom and there's a poster of this crazy monk from Wittenberg who's sort of making all the running among the young, hip people at that time. So Luther becomes a spectacularly important public figure in pop culture at that point. Next moment, what I call the year of triumph, tragedy, and bliss. 1525. I'm going to run for another 10 minutes and then give 5 minutes for questions at the end. Three big things happen in 1525. First of all, Luther engages in a major intellectual battle with Erasmus. Erasmus was the greatest intellectual of his day. He remained within the Catholic Church. He was the man who produced and published a decent Greek New Testament text and therefore paved the way for the Reformation. Every other reformer except for Martin Luther loves Erasmus. They are all Erasmians in background. They are all men of letters. They all love Erasmus's work to some extent. Luther hates Erasmus with a vengeance. When he hears of Erasmus's death in 1536, his only comment is, if only he died straight after producing the Greek New Testament, he wouldn't have done so much damage. Erasmus produced a work in 1524 under pressure from the Catholic Church to distance himself from Luther. Erasmus produces a work, a diatribe on the freedom of the will, in which he argues against the clearness of Scripture, that Scripture is fundamentally confusing, and therefore you need the Church to interpret for you, and on the fact that it's not clear that God is sovereign in salvation. Book arrives in Wittenberg. Luther's assistant, Philip Melanchthon, a brilliant young man, reads it, thinks it's wonderful, runs into Luther and says, this is great, Erasmus is with us. Luther reads it, says, this is horrific, Erasmus has never understood anything I've ever said, and produces in response his great work on the bondage of the will, which is probably the single greatest work Luther produced. When Luther himself was coming to the end of his life, he said the only books of his that were worth outliving him were his catechisms and the bondage of the will. So if you read only one thing by Luther, the bondage of the will is perhaps the thing to look at, in which Luther argues for the sovereignty of God in salvation and the fundamental clearness of Scripture on the issue of the gospel. Secondly, the tragedy of this year. All over Germany, the peasants revolt. They'd been struggling under, as people had moved to the cities, rents had been increasing, the standard of living was dropping dramatically in the countryside. The peasants revolt, they go into rebellion against their masters, and they use Luther's language to express this. Luther talked a lot about freedom, the freedom of the Christian, which he understood in a very distinct way, refracted through the cross. But for the peasants, it spoke to them of liberation from oppression. And so they use Lutheran rhetoric for social revolution. And it puts Luther in a real dilemma. Does he support the peasants? In which case he might lose the support of the knights who are protecting him and his reformation. So Luther produces a book known as the Harsh Book Against the Peasants, in which he effectively advocates for the butchering of rebellious peasants. And it's regarded as one of the two worst things that Luther ever wrote in his attempt really to keep the knights on side. The third event of the year is his marriage. In 1522, a group of nuns, as the Reformation is spreading over Germany, monasteries and nunneries are being closed down, a group of nuns hide themselves in fish barrels and escape to Wittenberg. And the obvious thing to do when you've got a bunch of sort of nuns arrive in town, and Wittenberg's only a small town, this is a very patriarchal society, you've got to marry them off and get them protected by a man. The obvious thing to do is to marry them to the monks. You're closing down the monastery, you're throwing all of these guys onto the market, let's just pair the nuns and the monks off, and that solves the social problem there. And there's one left, Catherine von Bora, who was quite a piece of work. She knew her own mind. Throughout her life, Lucas Cranach the Elder paints various portraits of her, and she always complained that he never made her as beautiful as she really was. So she was a tough lady. They can't find a husband for her. They keep coming up with these ex-monks and Lutheran pastors, and she didn't like any of them. And finally, in 1525, in sort of desperation, really, I don't think there's any real love or romance at the start, Luther and Katie get married. Becomes a very happy marriage. If you go to Wittenberg today, as a wedding present, they were given the Augustinian cloister, the Augustinian monastery, was given to them as a wedding present by the elector. And the doorway going into the house, there's a little seat on either side. And this doorway, this stone doorway, was actually a birthday present that Katie bought Martin because she didn't feel they were talking enough. So she had this doorway installed so at the end of each day, they could sit on either side of the door and talk to each other. And if you go upstairs in one of the only rooms left, which is pretty much as it was in the 16th century, there's a window with a similar setup, so that when it was raining, rarely rains in Northern Europe, as you all know, on the odd occasion that it was raining, they could go upstairs and sit in the window and talk to each other as well. She was a great home brewer. There's a love letter. I would never dare write a love letter like this to my wife. Luther wrote this love letter to his wife, and in it he says, if you could brew some of that great beer, because when I drink that, I have three bowel movements before noon. It was a much more earthy romance, I think, in those days than one would find today. I could never imagine mentioning bowel movements in a love letter myself. She was a great home brewer. And she really did, Luther was, by the time he got married, he was well into middle age, certainly by medieval standards. And she really did keep him in line and keep the household running smoothly. He was once asked, what difference has marriage made? And he says, before I got married, my sheets would be stinking and bored stiff with sweat before I would change them. And now they're kind of changed freshly, fairly regularly. They had six children. Two of them died. One of them died in infancy. One of them, Magdalena, lived till she was about 8 or 9. And Luther's account of her death and the moments leading up to her death and preparing the funeral is actually, it's very moving. And there's a famous painting of Luther preaching. And it's sort of classic Luther. He's in the pulpit and he's pointing across to Christ on the crucifix. And down you've got the congregation and you've got the Luther family. And two of the children have their faces are half covered by, looks like a scarf. And that was a convention of representing the dead children. That was a signal that this was the complete Luther family, but two of them were dead by the time the painting was produced. Very, very happy marriage on the whole. She seems to have been a very sweet lady. He refers to her in his letters continually as My Lord Katie, when he refers to other when he's writing about her to other people, My Lord Katie. He'll also call her his chain. Katharina is quite similar to the Latin word catena, and catena means chain. So he would refer to her as his chain quite regularly. But as I say, they seem to have enjoyed a very happy marriage. Because they were relatively poor, they rented the house they lived in, the cloister, There were always Wittenberg students there. It's still actually a seminary today. They still have students in the house today. Luther and Katie rented rooms to students and so shared their house with a continual throughput of people. And some of the fun stuff to read in Luther is his table talk. His followers wrote down his sort of jokes and witticisms that he would throw out at table. And they were collected in the table talk, which is, you can get it online. It's a fun thing to read. Final thing before I throw it open for questions. Disappointing end. In some ways, Luther's end, it was a great end. When you read the account of his death scene, he died as he should die. He died, you know, it was important that all of what we would often think of as the most private moments, literally from the consummation of the marriage to death, it was important that they were public events for Luther. I'm going to some of the more tasteless details. But it was important to have somebody there to witness these things because of who Luther was. You know, if on his wedding night, demons had appeared from the windows, that would have been a sign that this man was of the devil and not of God. I often say to the students, you know, as a sort of counterfactual history thing, what would have happened to the Reformation if Luther's first child had been stillborn? Because it would have been seen as judgment from God at that point. Well, Luther's death was witnessed by a number of people, and he died well. His last written words were, "We are beggars. This is the truth." And he had psalms read to him as he lay on his deathbed, and he died peacefully and well. Why do I describe it as a disappointing end? Because of the last sermon he preached. He's traveling through Germany. He's gone to Eisleben to sort out some disputes among the local nobility. He's managed to get to sort out the dispute, but he decides to stay in Eisleben and preach a couple of sermons. And his last sermon ends with a tirade against the Jews. It's a vicious tirade against the Jews. You go to churches in Germany and you look outside medieval churches, you'll often see a pig as a gargoyle. And the point is, Jews not welcome. The pig there is to keep the Jews from entering the church. And Luther's last sermon, he wrote very positively about the Jews earlier in his career, which is very surprising. But his last sermon is a bitter polemic against the Jews. I remember standing underneath the pulpit where he preached that sermon and praying, "Oh Lord, you know, I won't do a thousandth part for the church of what Martin Luther did, but please let my last sermon be a better one than the one he preached." And I think that, I just leave you with this, I think that's a reminder that greatest men have the greatest faults. Luther's stubborn pig-headedness was what allowed him to do what he did for good. But it also made him a great force for evil at points as well. So disappointing end. He actually died well, but his last sermon is among one of the worst things that he ever produced. So, that's a trolley bus tour, six key moments in Luther's life. We've got 5 minutes left. I'll take any questions you might have at this point. Yeah. I'm not quite sure of the answer to that question, but I'm guessing that the Reformation was not highly thought of in Nimschen, where they were. Word had got to them, and they decided to get out. They were effectively escaping. Katie had been a nun since she was very small. I mean, those days often the tradition was that the excess children, you'd give them to the monastery or the nunnery because they'd be looked after and they would have a calling. So she'd been a nun from a pretty early age. And I'm guessing that they were escaping from Nimschen, quite literally, having to hide themselves as they got out of town. Yeah. Nope, they never met. Calvin was a great admirer of Luther. As the Reform faith takes off, Calvin at some point is in the city of Basel as a young man. And Calvin's distinct among the trendy, hip, radical guys there as being the only one who looks to Luther as his guide. Everybody else looks to Zwingli and to Zurich. So Calvin had a lifelong love of much of Luther's theology. Couldn't go with him on the Lord's Supper. Was a great admirer of him, but they never actually met. And Calvin, as far as I know, did not read German. So Calvin would only have had access to Luther's Latin works. Yeah. Euclampadius, yeah. Yeah, Euclampadius. There's a great debate in the city of Marburg in 1529 between Luther and his allies and Zwingli and his allies. And Euclampadius, the reformer of Basel, is there, and he's one of Zwingli's allies. Yeah. The answer is sort of yes and no. Yes, he did. The baptism was what brought you into the church. In baptism, Christ is really offered to the recipient of baptism. But on the other hand, unless you grasp that baptism by faith, it was ultimately of no effect for you. So it's an interesting and odd take. It wasn't ex opere operato in the sort of Roman Catholic sense. It didn't do just by the act itself what it was supposed to do. You still had to grasp it by faith. I don't know enough about contemporary Lutheranism to say. I would say it's consistent with Book of Concord Lutheranism. And certainly when Luther's tempted by the devil, he says, "I've been baptized." He points the devil to his baptism. And when people would say to Luther, "You know, well, but you don't remember your baptism," he would say, That's ridiculous. I don't remember being born either, but I can point you to my parents. You know, I know I'm Hans Luther's son, but I don't remember popping out of my mother's womb." He also has another way of dealing with it. That was slightly distasteful. In one of his table talks, he says, "There was a woman in Magdeburg, when the devil came to tempt her, she broke wind in his face and it scared him away." But then he goes on to say, "But I don't recommend it." He said, "People can die of that." He said, "Because it's so dangerous and the devil gets so mad that he might kill you if you try it." So that's not an answer to your question, but I love throwing that anecdote in. Any other questions? Yeah. Philip Melanchthon was appointed professor of Greek at Wittenberg in 1519. When he's only 21, he's a remarkably brilliant talent. I think Luther is intimidated by Melanchthon's brilliance and also regards him as something of a son. By 1529, Melanchthon is arguing for what's really a fairly Erasmian position on salvation. We might anachronistically say it's kind of Arminian view of salvation. Interestingly enough, Luther never calls him on it. And historians have debated why that is. I think friendship defies rational historical analysis. I've got friends who are very different to me theologically. And I would never call them, I would write against their ideas, but I would always go after somebody else, not after this friend. I think friendship is a very powerful factor in life. And Luther never called Melanchthon out. Where it becomes problematic is after his death. Lutheranism splits between those who consider themselves the true followers of Luther and those who are the followers of Melanchthon. And ultimately, the followers of Melanchthon lose in Lutheranism. The Book of Concord is really what we call a Genesio-Lutheran document, taking its cue from the true Lutherans who claim to be the true heirs of Martin. So the friction really explodes after Luther's death in 1546, when Melanchthon's enemies, who think he's soft, particularly on the Lord's Supper, decide to come after him. Yeah, Robin. Yes. The strange thing about Luther is that in 1523 he writes a very positive book about the Jews, which is unusual for the time, because everybody hates the Jews. It's a complicated issue. One of the things we need to remember, I think, is it's not a racial issue in the 16th century. They don't really have a concept of race. The problem with the Jews is they're not baptized. They're not members of the church. So what do you do with them when everybody who's in the state is in the church and everyone in the church is in the state? What do you do with the group that stand outside that? The Anabaptists and the Jews are both problems because they're not baptized as babies. My thinking on Luther's change of mind, very simply, is this. In the early 1520s, Luther really thinks the world's about to end. He thinks the Reformation is the great revival at the end of time. The Jews are going to be converted, so we need to be nice to them to convert them. By 1543, the Reformation's going horribly wrong all over the place. There are setbacks. They're falling out with each other. Luther's ill. He knows his time is but short. And he knows that Christ isn't coming back. And he looks for somebody to blame. And he finds four groups to blame for this. The Turks, because they're pressing in from the east. The Papists, because they won't agree with Luther. The radical Anabaptists, because they're tearing the Protestant church apart. And the Jews, who won't convert to Christianity. So he launches polemics on all four of those. Of course, we look back at these things through the lens of the Holocaust. You know, Luther's writings were used as Nazi propaganda in the 20s and 30s. Now, you know, one can't say, therefore, Luther's a Nazi, but it is distressing that he wrote in such a way that the Nazis were able to pick up his stuff and use it. There's an excellent book called Demonizing the Jews, published by, I think it's the Holocaust Institute, which is a study of how Luther's writings were used by the Nazis in the run-up to the Holocaust. It is a profoundly disturbing book to read. And I think it's a salutary thing for any teacher to read to realize, well, you know, off-the-cuff remarks you make in class or things you write can be picked up and used in ways you never imagined. Take one more and then we'll... Yes. Yeah. Without the printing press, you couldn't have the Reformation. The printing press allowed for the building, for the first time, really, of the transmission of ideas in a relatively stable form rapidly across Europe. And also, you know, although the Reformation is a movement of the word, by and large, it's a movement of pictures at a popular level. And the Reformation proceeded by showing common people who couldn't read graphic pictures of what their opponents were up to. One of my favorite pictures that I deal with in the Reformation class at Westminster is one of the frontispieces from Fox's Book of Martyrs. And it's a wonderful frontispiece because the lesson of the frontispiece is sending is you can't trust pictures. It's a Protestant message, but it does it via a picture. And it's this incredibly sort of deconstructive. Yeah, you can't trust pictures. It's like you're looking at the liar paradox almost. But the printing press, specifically as it led to the rapid dissemination of pictures, is very important in the Reformation.